today's topical currents. Tuesday edition. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman returns tomorrow. Well, this hour we consider the realm of global shipping and the functions and perils of huge container ships. We visit with journalist and author Rose George. She earned her sea legs on a long journey aboard the container ship Maersk Kendall. It's longer than 3 football fields, higher than Niagara Falls. Rose George has written 90% of everything, Inside Shipping, the invisible industry that puts clothes on your back, gas in your car, and food on your plate. And she joins us from Yorkshire, England. Welcome to you, Rose George.
Thanks very much.
How could an industry with so many huge container ships and economic importance to the world be so invisible?
There's a few reasons. I think the biggest one is that the ships are so big. And so, for example, let's take New York. The ships used to be able to come into the wharves of Manhattan, unload there, and they were very much part of the fabric of everyday life in the city. And when containerization began, sort of in the 60s and 70s, and ships got bigger and bigger and bigger, ports had to be built to accommodate them. So now New Yorkers won't see ships coming into Manhattan, but they'll see them passing by going to New Jersey. Same in London, Liverpool. Lots of previously maritime cities have seen ports move to places that most people haven't really heard of, like Felixstowe and Tilbury and Immingham in the UK.
Actually, what are the biggest container ship ports in the world?
The biggest container, it's usually the competition between Shanghai and Hong Kong. They're usually in the top three. I'm not sure which one is currently thought to have the most volume. It's done by tonnage and volume, so it can vary.
And the largest U.S. port container-wise is Los Angeles.
I think it's Long Beach, yeah.
Yeah. In fact, we just had a news story on before we came on with this program about the 4 new Superpost Panamax cranes have arrived at the port of Miami. They're gearing up for the supersized ships that can then, of course, be going from Miami through the Panama Canal. So it's very important to the economy here.
It is, and in fact, and Panama is investing multi millions into widening the Panama Canal, which seafarers who have a certain charming humor call the Big Ditch. But so yes, there's a lot of money going into widening ships and the canal.
Now tell us about the importance in the container ship business of flags of convenience and the tax and legal ramifications of those flags of convenience.
Well, in the 60 or 70 years that the general public has sort of stopped noticing shipping, sort of since the Second World War when it was absolutely fundamental, bringing Europe all of its supplies, often from the US, quite a lot has changed in shipping. And one of the biggest things is the fact that although after the Second World War, the US, for example, had a fleet of 1,000 foreign-going vessels, and it now has fewer than 100 US-flagged ships. That doesn't mean that there aren't more American-owned ships. There are lots of American-owned ships, but 70% of ships now fly a flag that need have nothing to do with the country of their owner or the crew or the route. And they can be called either open registry flags or flags of convenience, depending on how you view them. And what's convenient about them is that they can save a ship owner millions because they provide the opportunity to have lower taxes, to not have unionized employees, and to employ anybody they want. And a lot of them offer anonymity as well, which is where the question about lawlessness comes from. There's lots of laws governing the sea. There's an international law of the sea, but the question is that when you can slip away behind the anonymity of a flag, the enforcement and the governments can be very difficult.
Well, let's define international waters. We had the 12-mile limit and then another 100 miles, which is considered an economic area, and then it's international waters?
Yes, then it's the high seas, which are, well, no man's land and no man's seas. So they are governed by international law, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, and various other international conventions. But yes, there is, outside 12 miles, really, you are in kind of no man's land.
So, in other words, if one of these ships has a flag of convenience, say from Panama, once it's in international waters, if there's a crime that occurs on that ship because it's a Panamanian flag, that means the Panamanian courts have jurisdiction?
Yes, and they will do the investigation. Yes. Which is something that I think a lot of cruise passengers don't even realize, because a lot of cruise ships are also flagged out, as it's known, to open registries. And it often baffles me that people will take such care of their personal security, making sure they've got a safe in their cabin, making sure that, they're going to be safe on board, but they don't pay attention to the flag.
And of course, some of these small countries that are flagging out these ships, they don't really care too much about justice in the international waters. They're
Some of them
not going to
don't.
pursue these cases very strong.
Well, a lot of them simply don't have the manpower to do it. They don't have the staff to do proper investigations. They don't have good investigative forces. They don't have FBIs. And I mean, some flags that are known as flags of convenience are actually pretty good flags. They do have pretty good standards. Panama is the biggest flag registry in the world and sometimes is pretty lax about investigating when it should, but yes, it's some of them. I mean, some of these flag registries belong to tiny Pacific islands that barely have a police force, but they have a flag registry.
Now, we often see containers carried by trucks on the highway. They're not as big as a tractor trailer rig, but they're like 20 feet long.
The standard unit of a container is called it's called a TEU. It's a 20-foot equivalent unit. Most of the ones we see there will be 40-foot units. There'll be two TEUs
On the truck.
Yes, I mean it could be a TEU or it could be a 40-foot unit that you see in a truck, but most commonly I think we see the 40-foot ones.
So I'm sure our listeners can imagine what that container looks like, and then the idea that the ship that you were on, the Kendall, can carry 15,000 of those.
No, so my ship was actually only carrying about 6,800.
Oh, only 6,800.
It was known at the time as a mid-sized container ship, even though I thought it was absolutely enormous. But now Maersk, the company whose ship I sailed on, the Kendall, they have just launched a ship called the Triple E, which can now carry 18,000 containers and is crewed by 22 people.
Now, how did you wind up going on the Kendall? How was that set up? And tell us more about Maersk. That's the largest shipping company in the world, I suppose.
Well, Maersk is the largest, profoundly important multinational that impacts on our lives that most of us have never heard of. So it has the its revenues are pretty much on a par with Microsoft, but we all know Microsoft because they make software, but we don't know Maersk, who bring us the computers. So I approached them because they're the biggest container shipping company, and because I knew they were pretty good, unusually in shipping, they were pretty good at being outward and talking to the press and trying to get a kind of public face. So I asked them if I could go on one of their ships, and I just kept asking, and eventually they said yes. Didn't take them long, just a couple of months, but they said yes, and which was within the shipping industry, there have been occasions when journalists have gone on ships, and then the companies who've let them on have come under some criticism from other people in the industry for letting journalists on. So it wasn't a small thing that they did.
So you were termed a supernumerary. What does that mean?
Yes, well, I looked that up in the dictionary. It seems to mean someone who doesn't really serve a particular purpose while on board. So I was not a paying passenger. I was not a passenger. I was, what's called a supernumerary. So I was sort of an addition to the crew, but not really crew. And I had very nice senior officer quarters that were kept for senior officers. It was a really, really nice ship, very comfortable. And yes, I spent 39 days on board with a crew of 21. And I thoroughly enjoyed it, but it taught me a lot about shipping and quite a lot that I found surprising.
I was surprised near the end of the book that you were almost sad to leave the ship.
I was very sad to leave the ship. I really didn't want to. I was very grumpy when I had to go down the gangway and disembark in Singapore. And I'd actually enjoyed being disconnected from the world, I suppose, and consumerism and stuff and screens. And because it was one of the surprising things was when I embarked on Kendal was that even a good ship like Kendal, which is run by a good company, even then, in 2010, the crew didn't have, for example, they couldn't browse the internet, they couldn't Skype or use any kind of equivalent, they could send email twice a day by dial-up, but that was it. They didn't have, you know, sort of communication levels that the basic, you know, an ordinary five-year-old would expect these days. So it is an isolated life still. There's no TV, your cell phone doesn't work, you've got a satellite phone if you need one, but that's quite expensive, so... But, I was only on there for 5 weeks, so I enjoyed that. I could enjoy that, but I don't think I'd do it for a living.
What's it like to board that ship for the first time and see how huge it is, and how long did it take you to develop some sea legs?
Well, I remember one of the first things I thought when I was wandering around the ship on that first day was, where are all the people? Because they were busy is one answer, because it's a very punishing job working on a ship. A ship needs constant care. It's always being assaulted by the elements. They're in port, there's lots of... They have to supervise the loading and unloading of all those containers. And so when seafarers aren't working, they're generally asleep or eating very fast. So I was surprised to see no one about. And then when we had dinner together, I was surprised at how few people there were. I suppose my sea legs, I suppose, developed after about 2 or 3 days. I started to walk a bit differently. Mm-hmm. It took me a bit longer to get used to the vibrations, which are caused by an engine the size of a house. I had to keep leaping up out of bed and going and sticking pieces of paper under in hinges and behind TVs and stuff to stop the vibrating. But I didn't get sick much because it's such a big ship, and she's also got wings, so they're called fins really, but they can put out these fins or wings to stabilize the ship. So we didn't have much rough weather, thankfully.
We're speaking with journalist and author Rose George. We're talking about her book about the shipping industry. It's called 90% of Everything. We're going to take a short break and be back with more. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman returns tomorrow. We're speaking with journalist and author Rose George about her book, 90% of Everything. She's joining us from Yorkshire, England. Rose George, I'm told that tomorrow you're traveling to Singapore. Are you going on another big ship adventure?
I wish I were. No, I'm not. I'm going to do... another TED talk, actually. I did one earlier this year, so I'm going to give a talk on shipping. Appropriately in Singapore, as it is, it's a very big port in Asia. It's very important. So I'm expecting I'll be talking to some people who already know some of what I'm talking about. But no, I'm flying.
You left on the Kendal from the port of Rotterdam, of course, in the Netherlands. I always thought that was the biggest container shipping port, but it's down like 10th.
Yes, I think it might be the biggest port in Western Europe or even in Europe, but it's huge. I mean, it's 40 miles long, but there are certainly bigger ports.
Tell us about the loading of the ship. On the Kendal, there were 6,000 of these containers. I suppose they have to be arranged for proper ballast and also for which ports you're going to hit first to be able to unload without going through a lot of trouble.
To be very frank, I cannot get my head around the intricacies of loading a ship, and I absolutely take my hat off to the people who do it, because exactly, you've got so many things to factor in. If you want one box to come off at one port, then it has to be somewhere on the ship. You've got to consider ballast, because going towards Asia, a lot of ships coming out of Europe are pretty empty, because the UK, for example, doesn't export very much anymore. So there are all those considerations, and then you've got the added considerations of pirates. So we were going through the Indian Ocean, so there are certain, we were carrying some hazardous chemicals, and you don't want those loaded onto the outsides of the stacks where they could be hit by an RPG, a rocket-powered grenade. So there are all sorts of considerations, and the first officer, Vinton, was a very, very laid-back Indian guy, but as soon as I asked him about the cargo, which was his responsibility, he was sharp as a tack. He knew exactly how many boxes were on board. He could have told me where they were. What he didn't know was what was in them, because there was no manifest kept on board.
They didn't know what the containers held.
They didn't know, and they didn't care, because to them it's just the job of getting containers from A to B. So the only contents that they knew about were the hazardous materials, because they needed to know what was in those boxes in case a fire broke out, so they would know how to deal with the fire. But other than that, they had no idea.
So you left Rotterdam, and what was the first port then that you made?
No, I left from Felixstowe, actually, in England. And then we went round the top of Europe to Bremerhaven was the first port, which is a German port, and then we came back round and called in at Rotterdam. Then we had a port in France, Le Havre, and then that was it for quite a while, about 7 days. We went down through Suez, through the Gulf of Aden, through some pretty nerve-wracking pirate waters, and then our next port was Salalah in Oman.
Shalala.
Salalah, it's a lovely name. And it was very lovely to reach that port after 5 days of pirate watch, I can tell you. Yes, it's a port on the south of Oman, and it's got a very nice restaurant with what the crew delighted in eating, some very, very large steaks.
So you went from Rotterdam, I guess then through Gibraltar and into the Mediterranean, and then through the Suez Canal. What was going through the Suez Canal like?
Well, I was really excited about it, because I'd not been through Suez, and I've still not been through Panama. So so I would talk to the crew about it and say, Suez is coming up, it's great. And they would just look at me as if I were mad, because they went through it every month. And they said, it's just a ditch in a desert. But it was still, nonetheless, despite their cynicism, it was still pretty exciting to wake up. And it's very green water. And then along the sides, you've got you've got desert, but also there's some green trees that have been planted there. And you go through for, I think it was 12 to 18 hours it took us to go down. And you have to go down in convoy, so you're hanging around for a bit at the top of the canal, then you go down. It's only one-way traffic through Suez. But it, after about 4 or 5 hours of it, I did start to understand the ditch in the desert thing.
And it wasn't necessarily an easy trek. You would think just to go through the canal is a straight shot, but your captain had to be really on his toes.
Well, he did, because he had had an incident with a slightly inattentive Suez pilot, and he had been on a ship that had gone aground, it beached on some sand, and he'd managed to get it off because he's a very skilled captain. But he didn't. He was very conscious of that. So, and the other thing about going through Suez is it costs quite a lot of money to go through. I think it's about $300,000. That's not all it costs. You also need to pay your way in Marlboro cigarettes. So everyone involved in going through Suez, the government requires you to take on certain crew, a Suez crew, to operate. I'm not sure what they were supposed to operate. It wasn't really quite clear.
Sort of like a tender? Or?
Well, they came on a little sort of skiff, and they attached their boat to the side, and then they had their own Suez crew room, and they hung out there for a couple of days, eating and drinking and sleeping, and I'm not sure what they were there for. I think they were there to, in case anything happened, they could operate ropes that were specific to the Suez Canal. I think it was something like that. But they were very good at selling souvenirs. But everybody needed their Marlboro. So the seafarers used to joke that they didn't think that Egypt could have actually built the pyramids because there was no Marlboro then.
Tell me, with a ship the size of Kendall, What kind of daily operating budget, considering fuel and crew and associated expenses, what does it cost daily to operate that ship?
Well, fuel alone, I think at that point, was about $100,000 or something. And then if you're going through Suez on that particular day, then you're looking at $500,000. So the crew were on, I don't know, the captain wouldn't tell me what his salary was. But the Filipino crew, the non-officers, were on, I think, around $1,000 US a month. So, you know, it costs a lot of money to run a ship. And the margins in container shipping are very tight because it's a very competitive business. And that's how we get such cheap T-shirts and cheap TVs. It's because the margins are so tight in shipping.
I think most people would think it'd be sort of an adventure to go on to a big container ship like that, that you'd be going to see a lot of ports. But these crew members rarely got off the ship.
They got off the ship, but not for more than a couple of hours at a time, partly because they didn't have time. Sometimes the ports were so huge. For example, Rotterdam, 40 miles long, it would have cost them about $50 or $60 to get a taxi into town. And they're saving up to get off the sea, so they don't want to spend their money on taxis into town. So they often didn't have time to go ashore at all, but they were desperate to because they wanted to Skype home and talk to their families. And luckily, in most ports around the world, and I'm sure in Miami as well, there are seafarers' missions or welfare centers run by various, usually religious charities, who do a fantastic job. Because they provide a center where seafarers can use the internet, can call home, get whatever they need, a SIM card or a battery, and they do an amazing job.
We're speaking with Rose George, journalist and author, and we're talking about her book, 90% of Everything. We're going to take another short break and be back with more. And we return. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman returns tomorrow. And we're talking about the world of container ships and the huge, huge industry that it is. And it's almost an invisible industry. In fact, our guest Rose George has written 90% of Everything, Inside Shipping, the Invisible Industry that Puts Clothes on Your Back, Gas in Your Car, and Food on Your Plate. And by the way, our Topical Currents Facebook page, as well as the WLRN.org website, will have links to Rose George's books, and you can learn more about her. Is there a website that you have, Rose, dedicated to the book? Or?
Yeah, there is. It's called 90%ofeverything.com.
90% of Everything. If you'd like to join in with a comment or a question, you're certainly welcome. Our number is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. WLRN, and also email is open. That's radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org. Now, you touched a little bit about the piracy and the rather difficult crossing of the Indian Ocean, where people had to be so aware and always be on watch. Tell us more about the roots of the piracy in the Somalians.
There are various theories. Probably some of them, all of them, are a little bit true. So the most popular myth that you'll hear from pirates themselves is that they were poor fishermen, and over the years, as Somali broke down and became a failed, lawless state with a very terrible civil war, foreign fishing trawlers came in from all over the place, from Taiwan, from Spain, from Russia, and stole all their fish and their livelihoods. There is some truth to that. But there are other origin myths around Somali piracy, and that's that it was fueled by inland criminal gangs who came in and got in on the act. But whatever the truth, the reality for about 15 years was that there were plenty of young men willing to set out in small boats on the Indian Ocean and try and hijack passing ships, and they were very good at it.
Now, what were some of the tactics of this business of cutting off ears and sending it back for ransom?
Well, this, I heard earlier on your show that someone talking about the new film Captain Phillips,
yes.
Which I've seen, which I do recommend that people see, because it does give a real insight into what a pirate attack looks like. And what a pirate attack looks like is A, terrifying, and B, very fast. So if a skiff can approach a ship, because ships, some of them are going, okay, they'll go a bit faster in pirate waters, probably about 18 knots, but that's still not very fast at all. So if a small boat manages to reach one of these ships and then they throw up a grappling ladder, then they'll get on board. They can be on board within 15 minutes. And they can be on the bridge within 15 minutes. So it's very, very rapid. And that's why it's often very difficult for military patrols to reach them in time. Then once the seafarers are taken hostage, there are all sorts of treatments meted out to them with varying degrees of brutality. And piracy was often called, over the last decade, was called a bloodless business because it was seen as just, you know, hostages were taken, ransoms were paid, and that was that. But it was never a bloodless business, and ears have been cut off. Someone had their arm amputated. A hostage that I interviewed, Chirag Bahri, who was held hostage for over a year. He was held. He was tied up on the deck in 40-degree heat in a stress position, and his genitals were tied together with cable ties. And he was left in that position for 4 or 5 hours. His captain was locked in the ship's deep freezer in his underpants for a day or so. So when people talk about the bloodless business of piracy, I get quite irate, because I think all you have to do is talk to a hostage and you'll know that it was no such thing.
Now, do they arm the container ships?
They do now, and I think that's the biggest reason why Somali piracy has diminished dramatically. There hasn't been a successful attack on a big ship since May 2012. There are a few reasons for that. One is that the military patrols have been quite successful, even though they have a pretty tall order patrolling the whole Indian Ocean. But I think the biggest reason is that now the shipping industry generally puts armed guards on ships going through the Indian Ocean, and pirates are not stupid. And if they approach a ship and it fires back, then they'll rapidly retreat. So, yes, most ships now carry armed guards. That wasn't the case when I traveled through in 2010, and we weren't allowed armed guards on the ship, although all the crew wanted them.
Tell us more about the crews, the relationships among the multinational members.
Well, around my dining table in the officer's mess, I was sitting next to a Burmese guy. I was opposite a Romanian, a Moldavian, an Indian, two Brits. Behind me was a Chinese third engineer, another two British cadets or apprentices. And then in the crew room was entirely Filipino. And that's a pretty normal ship. You'll often find at least 5 or 6 nationalities, and you'll often find a Filipino crew because, in their words, we are cheap and we speak good English. And they have a very big maritime sort of education sector, so they have a lot of maritime colleges, and it's seen as a good career for a Filipino to go to sea.
Now, what about the guys who tend that huge engine? You've been in the engine room while they're operating. What's it like?
I have. I did put it off for as long as I could because I knew that it was going to be extremely hot and extremely noisy, and it was both of those things. Because the engines are absolutely enormous. They are the size of a house. And they have to be to operate a ship that's 300 meters long to push it through water. So I had a tour of the engine room, but I have to admit that I didn't stay there as long as the engineers probably would have liked. I think they would have liked to show me more of it. But it was just too hot. And that wasn't as hot as it can get. It can get 50 degrees down there.
What's the range on the Kendall with a full fuel tank?
You mean the speed?
The range. How far can it go?
With a full... I don't know, actually. No one's ever asked me that. I know how fast it can go. It can go at 23 knots, but I don't know. I'd have to ask the captain.
Well, how often did you fuel?
Well, we did bunkers in Rotterdam, which is what's called, it's called doing bunkers because ships use this rather horrible stuff called bunker fuel, which is the dregs of the refinery, but it's cheap. So we did bunkers in Rotterdam, and then I think we didn't refuel again for a while. I don't remember. I think we did maybe Malaysia. But I could be wrong, because no one's ever asked that before, and I didn't really pay attention to the bunkers, because it usually happened when I was asleep.
And the how long a shift, say, do some of these workers in the engine rooms have to endure down there?
Well, it depends if they're officers or crew. So the officers will all have 2 4-hour watches in a working day, and then they'll have other hours on top, and those other hours will depend on what else there is to be done. And the crew, I think, did 8 to 10-hour days, I think. But then again, it depended. So, for example, in pirate zones, there would be double bridge watch. So that just meant 2 guys on the bridge wings, which are kind of the little terraces that come out from the bridge. They would be on, there would be 24-hour watch. So that was exceptional.
Now, you say in the book that Maersk doesn't allow any alcohol on board. So after these guys work in the engine rooms, they can't even go and have a cold beer.
No, they can't. And the Maersk has reasons for that, and that is that alcohol is involved with accidents, and being on a ship is an intrinsically dangerous environment, not least because you're on the incredibly potentially dangerous ocean, but also you're surrounded by metal and machinery, and there's wind and rain, and accidents happen a lot. So I guess Maersk's thinking was to reduce, you know, to increase health and safety by banning alcohol, but it certainly wasn't a popular decision. They didn't, I mean, the crew didn't want to go out and get very, very drunk every night, but they would have liked to, as you say, after a hard day, just chill out and hang out together over a beer. And in fact, when Kendall, although I really loved being on board, it was remarkably unsociable, particularly in the evenings. But even around mealtimes, people didn't generally talk. There were only a few people who talked, and they ate very fast. They fueled rather than ate. I later went on a warship, a Portuguese warship doing counter-piracy, and the difference there was really dramatic because they had 1,000 people on board, more or less, and they made a real effort for people to socialize because they knew that that kept up morale and that that was good for welfare, and that also means that people want to go and work at sea, whereas there didn't seem to be that awareness in the merchant shipping industry.
I was amazed to read in your book that during World War II, maritime sailors had the highest percentage of casualties in the entire war.
Proportionately, yes, they did. But they weren't considered military. They were in a peculiar position, so, which led to the extraordinary fact that they weren't even given veterans' medals till the early 1980s in the U.S. And even later in the U.K., only recently, they've been awarded Merchant Navy veterans' medals, which is astonishing considering how incredibly brave they were.
Now, with the crew, there's no socializing over a cold beer. You say they just kind of wolf down their food. They must be incredibly bored.
I think they're incredibly tired. And, but yes, when, you know, when I, everyone, it's kind of a modern affliction that people just go back to their rooms and look at their laptops and watch DVDs. I mean, we all do that ashore, and they do that at sea as well, but it's kind of magnified at sea because there is no other outlet. The only other outlet is to jump overboard. So it's not an ideal way to be at sea, and there is a risk of depression. There are suicides at sea. I mean, luckily the rates aren't any higher than they are on land, but it's an issue, and seafarers' welfare is an issue. And, you know, if you ask any of my crew what do they do on board, they say we watch the DVDs and then we watch them again.
What's it like on the bridge or the wheelhouse of a ship of that size?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's majestic. You've got all these windows around you. You've got the ocean around you. At night, you've got this just magnificent black sky. I loved being on the bridge. I mean, you decide when you go on a ship which tribe you're going to be, whether you're going to be the engine room or bridge, whether you're going to be oil or water, as they say, or deck or engine room. But I definitely knew where my preference was, and that was just to be sitting up on the bridge, not even doing anything in particular, just sitting there while the watch officer did what he had to do, did his admin tasks. But just to sit there and watch the sea go by was a real privilege.
Now, when you're on the bridge, how far up are you from the surface of the sea, roughly?
So our freeboard was 10 meters. That's the side of the ship between the sea and the deck. And then we were, I'm just trying to calculate, I think we were 10 stories up. But I wouldn't be able to give you that in feet.
So, but roughly a 10-story building.
Yeah, or higher, yeah.
That's hard to fathom, really. And
these are very big ships.
And before you are all these containers when you look down from the bridge, then.
Yeah, wherever you look, there are containers, apart from above you, if you're on the bridge. You look down onto containers, and you'll see them behind you.
Well, when we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit more about the Kendall Captain Glenn. But we're going to take a short break now, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. We're speaking with Rose George about her book, 90% of Everything. It's about the huge shipping industry worldwide. And she spent, 5 weeks aboard the ship Kendall. Is that correct?
Yep, 39 days, yeah.
And what was it like being the only woman on board? Or I guess the cook was a woman.
Cook was a woman, yes, Pinky. Pinky, yeah. It was fine. I mean, I was a little bit nervous. I mean, at the beginning, I always kept my cabin door locked, but eventually, you know, after a few days, I relaxed and I did what everyone else did, which is keep your cabin door open most of the day. I was treated very well. A lot of women who do go to sea, and there are only 2% of seafarers who are women, some of them do have pretty rough experiences, but I was lucky.
And how was the chow from Pinky?
Well, I'm vegetarian, and she took a few weeks to get her head around that. So for the first few weeks, I did eat rather a lot of chips. That's French fries and salad. But then eventually, after a few weeks, she started making me really delicious soups. So she came through.
I suppose with the hard work that the crew members do, they have to have some pretty substantial meals.
They do, but to be honest, the level of catering, bless her, Pinky, she's lovely, but she'd learned European cooking in about 3 weeks, and she did come up with some interesting meals that were not always as palatable as they could be. So I wasn't generally eating them, because that was generally the meat and fish dishes, but I know that a couple of the crew did kind of come in and look at the counter with some puzzlement sometimes, but they ate a lot of food, but it probably could have been better nutrition. They need to keep fit, and there is a gym on board, but they're doing a very, particularly the non-officers are doing manual labor. They're doing heavy manual labor, so they need to fuel. But the Filipinos always had a rice pot that was always full of rice, and they had a huge supply of ramen noodles in their counter. So I used to sneak into their room and take some of their noodles with permission.
Now, you spent a lot of time and interviewed the ship's captain. Tell me more about Captain Glenn.
Captain Glenn is from the northeast of England, which is a traditional seafaring place. He's what's called a Geordie.
A Geordie?
A Geordie. That's what Geordie. People around Newcastle are called. And he was sort of the best captain I could have had, really, because he was a senior captain in the Maersk fleet. He'd been at sea for 42 years, and he was a very good captain. He was very skilled. He was a very skilled navigator, but he also had lots of stories. And he'd also, in a way, he kind of exemplified the changes in shipping, because when he started, there hadn't been any containers. He remembers seeing his first container as a cadet, as an apprentice, and the crew saying, oh, that'll never catch on. And so he'd really grown up in shipping alongside containerization, and he'd seen the industry change, and he had good days and bad days when he was more positive about it, but most of the time he thought the industry and the job had changed for the worse.
I wonder what kind of salary a senior captain would make.
So do I. He wouldn't tell me.
Hmm.
I did ask him. Yeah, he had a nice car, he had a nice house, he'd put extensions on his house. He's going to be on a pretty good salary, and it was tax-free. But he did not tell me.
I was interested in the book. You talked about that sometimes when the crew would go ashore, they had to stay close by in the port, and they were always on concrete, and they really wanted just to be able to walk on some grass.
Well, that was something that was told to me by one of the seafaring mission chaplains who I mentioned before, who operate the seafarers' welfare missions in port. And that was a wonderful chaplain called Father Colum, who works in a north of England port called Immingham, which is pretty ugly, full of coal dust, but he absolutely loves it. Anyway, he told me this story that a ship came in, and as he does every day when a ship comes in, he goes and visits the ship, he goes on board, and he says, I'm here to help you, what can I do for you, what can I fetch you? And usually they want a battery or a SIM card, or they want a catalogue from a cheap store that they can buy stuff they need. But in this instance, it was a bunch of Indians, and they said, we just want to walk on green grass. And the captain said, we're surrounded by metal all the time, even though we're on the water, all our environment is metal, and we want some green grass. So he put them in the mission van, and he drove them about half an hour away, and he found a churchyard. And they took off their shoes, and they walked on the grass, and then they put their shoes back on. They went back in the van, back on the ship, and off they went.
How about the environmental consequences? You talk about how there's also acoustic pollution in the ocean from the noise of the ships, that affects whales.
Yes, I mean, environmentally, shipping has been, the consequences of shipping have been quite unseen for a long time, and just to talk about what they do to the air, first of all, I mean, shipping emissions are between 3% and 4%, and that's pretty much on a par with Germany and with aviation. So that even though shipping is really the greenest method of mass transport, it emits fewer emissions per ton per mile than aviation by a thousandth. But it's not benign because there's so much of it. So there is that issue, but something that really interests me that I didn't know about and hadn't thought about was that in the ocean, creatures communicate by sound because light doesn't penetrate, and they no longer live in a quiet ocean. I mean, there have always been noises in the ocean, breaking waves and things, but the impact of man-made activity in the ocean now is pretty significant and quite damaging for some, for example, whales. So I looked at a particular whale called the North Atlantic right whale, which is known to live and feed off the eastern seaboard, and I think summers down near Florida somewhere.
That's right, R-I-G-H-T.
Right, the right whale,
correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was named the right whale because during the hunting centuries, when it died, it would float, and it was full of blubber, so it was the right whale to hunt. But the North Atlantic right whale now is one of the most endangered creatures on the planet, and some of that could be due to the acoustic pollution that is affecting its breeding patterns, that is maybe affecting its ability to feed, to find mates, and to communicate with other whales, because a lot of shipping propellers make a noise that's on the same frequency as that many whales use. So some humpback whales now have had their acoustic habitat or range reduced by up to 90%. And some of that is due to shipping, not all of it, but some of it is due to shipping propellers.
And of course, sound travels much better in water than in air.
Sound travels much more efficiently in water, yes. A humpback can be heard, can transmit a call across an ocean, but so can a supertanker. You can hear a supertanker coming a day before it arrives in the water. So all sorts of noise is powerful in water, the good kind and the bad kind.
Well, before we go, tell us a little bit more about the ship chaplain and what the chaplain at the mission that you interviewed.
Father Colum. Right. Father Colum is one of my heroes. He's what every sort of priest should be. He's just a kind, caring, untiring man doing a job that he gets very little money for and very little thanks for, apart from seafarers who are his parish. And he absolutely loves his parish, even though he lives in, as I said, quite ugly port. But he says that he just goes downstairs every morning. He lives in an apartment above the Seafarers Centre. He goes downstairs every morning, and he doesn't know which part of the world is going to be walking through his doors that day. It could be someone from Cape Verde. It could be someone from Burma. It could be a Filipino. It could be a Russian or Ukrainian, anything. And he just does his best for them. And he plays a really valuable role, and lots of people who do his job, and there are lots of people doing it, volunteers as well, play a really valuable role, being a sort of listening post for seafarers.
Well, we've just about run out of time. I want to thank Rose George for joining us from Yorkshire, England. Her book is 90% of Everything, Inside Shipping, the Invisible Industry That Puts Clothes on Your Back, Gas in Your Car, and Food on Your Plate. Thank you very much, Rose George.
Thank you.
And thanks for joining us. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from Michael Stock. Paul Leary is online producer. Free audio archives and downloads at our website, wlrn.org, and more information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program considers how habitat loss has forced animals to live with humans in urban areas. We see foxes, raccoons, egrets, possums, and other wildlife living in our midst. And to the calendar, October the 8th. On this day in 1871, 142 years ago, the Great Chicago Fire erupts and burns for 2 days. The business of Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicking over a lantern is a myth. 300 died, 100,000 were left homeless. After 2 days, only rain stifled the flames. Also on this day in 1965, 48 years ago, President Lyndon Johnson has gallbladder surgery. Showing class, he's the first and only president to show a scar on television. One more while we consider our one love. On this day in 1980, 33 years ago, reggae giant Bob Marley collapses on stage in Pittsburgh in what proved to be his final performance. He was diagnosed with a brain tumor. He died in Miami 7 months later. We leave with a thought from Lyndon Johnson, whose third heart attack killed him in 1973. Quote, "I once told Nixon that the presidency is like being a jackass caught in a hailstorm. You just got to stand there and take it." President Obama is scheduled to hold a news conference at the White House in the next hour, and we'll go to NPR's Here and Now for live coverage, so stay tuned. This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making public radio your companion today.